Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drower, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss the decision handed down on February 22nd in Barton Werfer v. Buckley. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Thomas Plank. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Tennessee College of Law, where he taught bankruptcy, property, and commercial law for 27 and a half years. He has published over 30 articles on bankruptcy and commercial law issues, and before then, he practiced for 19 years as a lawyer, including 7 years as issuer's counsel and bankruptcy counsel for securitizations and structured finance transactions. And he continues to serve as a part-time consultant on bankruptcy and uniform commercial code issues in securitizations and structured finance transactions. And we're very happy to have him on SCOTUScast today to talk about the case. So I think you've got some prepared remarks to talk about the background of the case, the facts of the case, and how the decision came down and your opinions on it. So with that, I will hand things over to you with thanks, many thanks for joining us.
Well, great. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and to talk with everyone who happens to be listening. I think this case presents a very interesting issue. It's on the extent to which an individual debtor who has liquidated her assets under Chapter 7 of the Bankruptcy Code and received a discharge of her debts is barred from discharging a debt arising from the fraud of another person. Specifically, the statute involved is Section 523A2A of the Bankruptcy Code, and it states, quote, "A discharge does not discharge an individual from any debt for money to the extent obtained by false pretenses, false representation, or actual fraud." Now, the issue is whether this exception to discharge extends to an innocent debtor who did not commit and had no knowledge of the fraud, but who under state law is vicariously liable for the fraud as a partner in a partnership. The court ruled that the vicarious liability of the innocent debtor did bar the innocent debtor's discharge. Now, the court's decision was unanimous. The opinion is very well written and well reasoned. Nevertheless, I believe the court's decision is wrong. On the surface, the issue presented appears to be a narrow one. However, I believe the narrow issue in this case is an example of a larger, more fundamental issue of federal bankruptcy law. And that is the relationship between A, the bankruptcy code and bankruptcy policy on the one hand, and in this case, the law governing discharge and exceptions, and B, the underlying non-bankruptcy law, which is mainly state law, and policy that in this case created the liability. I think failure to recognize and analyze this fundamental issue can lead the court to an erroneous result, and the court's opinion is an example. The facts are relatively simple. Petitioner, then Kate Pfeffinger, and now Kate Bartonwerfer, and her then fiance and now husband, David Bartonwerfer, bought a house in San Francisco that needed extensive renovation. David remodeled the house, and Kate, who worked at a medical supply company, had very little involvement in the renovation. Kate and David put the house on the market and filled out a transfer disclosure statement required by California law. Kate relied on David for questions within his knowledge. David and Kate then sold the house to the respondent, Kieran Buckley. Buckley found problems with the house and sued David and Kate in state court for failure to disclose certain defects. The jury found both liable for non-disclosure of material facts and awarded Buckley more than $200,000 in damages. David and Kate each filed for bankruptcy. Adversary complaint by Buckley, the bankruptcy court held that David was barred from discharge because of his fraud. However, the Ramsey Court, after remand from an appeal, determined that Kate, although a general partner in a partnership with David in renovating the house, and therefore vicariously liable for David's fraud under state law, did not have or have reason to know of David's fraud, and therefore her discharge was not barred. Upon appeal, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed on the basis of an 1885 Supreme Court case, Strang v. Bradner, which we'll discuss in a bit, and held that the debt of Kate, though an innocent partner, was not dischargeable. Because of a split among the circuits, the court granted a writ of certiorari, and the court held that the exception from discharge for debts for money obtained by fraud applied not only to the debtor who committed the fraud, but also to an innocent debtor who was vicariously liable for the fraud. First, as appropriate, the court stated with an analysis, the court started with an analysis of the language of section 523A2A. The court stated that the text of the statute precluded the petitioner from discharging her debt because her debt for the money obtained by David's fraud is a, quote, debt for money obtained by fraud, close quote, under the statute. Quote, court said, quote, written in the passive voice, section 323-2A turns on how the money was obtained, not on who committed the fraud. Undoubtedly, the statute does not expressly state who the fraudulent actor must be. The petitioner argued that the natural reading of the statute, nevertheless, is that the money be obtained from the fraud of the debtor seeking the discharge. The court rejected this argument because, in its view, the plain language, quote, pulled the act off the stage, close quote. Court cites from Brian Gardner, Modern English Usage, the 2016 edition, that the passive voice signifies that, quote, the actor is unimportant or, quote, unknown, close quote. Here's my first disagreement with the court's analysis. First, strictly speaking, the sentence comprising 523A2A uses the active voice, not the passive voice. A discharge does not discharge an individual debtor from a certain debt. The passive voice analysis of the court relates to the description of the debts accepted from discharge, debt from, quote, money to be obtained to the extent obtained by fraud. The court is correct that this use of the past participle obtained to modify money puts the emphasis on how the money was obtained, and that emphasis seems appropriate. But the use of the passive in the modifying phrase obtained by fraud does not automatically dictate that the actor is unimportant. According to Fowler's Dictionary of Modern English Usage, 2015 edition, the passive form is also perfectly acceptable when the actor has already been named. And in this case, there's a strong argument that the actor has already been mentioned. Again, section 523A2A provides that, quote, discharge does not discharge an individual debtor from any debt for money to the extent obtained fraud. This use of the active voice in section 523 puts the spotlight on the specific debtor, in this case, the petitioner, Kate Burton Walford, seeking discharge. Accordingly, it is perfectly natural to read section 523A2A to limit the disqualifying debt to money obtained by the fraud of the individual debtor seeking discharge, and not to fraud committed by some other person. Now, this natural reading is not necessarily conclusive. Nevertheless, the absence of any reference to whose fraud bars discharge, at the very least, makes this provision genuinely ambiguous. Garner's Modern English Usage, and here I'm relying on the 2022 edition, remarks that omitting the actor is, quote, prime source of unclarity, close quote. Prior decisions by the court, which it cited in this case, make the same point. My own experience in drafting and interpreting documents and legislation and teaching bankruptcy code and Article 9 of the UCC is that the use of the passive voice is almost always ambiguous. In addition, although Garner's list of six reasons for the use of the passage does not include the instance in which the actor has already been mentioned, he states that his list explains only 15 to 20% of the context when the passive voice is actually appears. Now, I am a committed textualist along the lines of Justin Antonin Scalia. Nevertheless, I do agree that when the text is genuinely ambiguous, courts must look to other sources to determine the meaning of the text, including context, statutory history, and longstanding and authoritative statements of policy for the statutory provision. In the second part of the opinion, the court stated that its 1885 precedent, Strang v. Bradner, quote, eliminates any doubt about our textual analysis, close quote. Strang interpreted a provision of the Bankruptcy Act of 1867 that was a precursor to 523A2A. Section 33 of the 1986 Act stated, quote, no debt created by the fraud or embezzlement of the bankrupt shall be discharged under this act, close quote. The court noted that this language limited the exception to discharge to the fraud of the bankrupt, which reflected petitioner's interpretation of section 523A2A. And the facts in Strang were similar to the facts in this case. Strang and two brothers, the Holland brothers, formed a general partnership doing business as commission merchants. Strang defrauded one of the partnership's customers without the participation or knowledge of the Holland brothers. The partnership then became insolvent. In the partners' bankruptcy cases under the 1867 Act, Strang and the Holland brothers received a discharge of their debts other than the debts created by fraud. The victims then sued Strang and the Holland brothers in New York State Court and obtained a verdict and judgment notwithstanding the death defense discharge. New York Court of Appeals affirmed and the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed. In my view, however, Strang is not a controlling precedent for two reasons. First, the 1867 Act expressed Congress's intent to enact much greater restrictions on granting discharges than the current code or the Bankruptcy Act of 1898, which I'll mention in a minute. For example, under Section 33 of the 1867 Act, if creditors received dividends of less than 50% of their claims, no discharge was granted unless a majority of creditors in number and value consented. The 1867 Act contained a long list of grounds for total denial of discharge in Section 29, more than 17 clauses as I've counted it. It also contained exceptions from discharge, not total denial, but exceptions from discharge for two categories of fraud in Section 33. It was estimated that fewer than one-third of the debtors received discharges under the 1867 Act. Second, the court in Strang thoroughly analyzes the validity of the claims of fraud by Strang, but only in the last paragraph did the court address the question of the liability of the Holland brothers as the innocent partners. The court held that the fraud of Strang was to be imputed to all persons of the firm for purposes of this action under applicable state law. Therefore, the Holland brothers were liable to the victims. In this discussion, the court focused on the rule that creates liability for all general partners for the fraud of one party. It did not analyze any aspect of the rules or policy of discharge or non-discharge for innocent partners. It simply equated liability for fraud with the exception to discharge. Now, given the then view preferring a more limited discharge, perhaps this is not surprising. Now, the court in Bartonwerfer then stated that the holding in Strang was incorporated into the discharge provisions in the Bankruptcy Act of 1898 on the presumption that Congress is aware of the court's precedents. In my view, this rule doesn't apply in this case. As Charles Tabb has described in his 1991 History of the Discharge, the 1898 Bankruptcy Act enacted dramatic pro-debtor changes to the discharge. In his words, quote, the 1898 recognized formally for the first time The overriding public interest in granting a discharge to honest but unfortunate debtors. The debtor is then able to resume his or her place as a productive member of society. The 1898 drastically curtailed the number of statutory grounds for total denial of discharge from 17 to just 2, and it eliminated the minimum creditor recovery or creditor consent for discharge. Using a more targeted approach, the 1898 Act did expand a list of grounds for exceptions of certain debts from discharge from 2 in the 1867 Act to 5 in the 1898 Act, including debts incurred from fraud. In addition, the structure of the exception of debt for money obtained by fraud from discharge in Section 17, as in Section 523A2A, differs dramatically from that of Section 33 of the 1867 Act. Specifically, Section 17 of the 1898 Act stated that, quote, a discharge in bankruptcy shall release a bankrupt from all his provable debts except, and then there's a list of about five, one of them are judgments in actions for fraud or obtaining property for false judgments or false representations. As a court remarked, this section 17 removed the phrase of the 1867 Act of the bankrupt, following the word fraud. This change, however, is not as important as it may appear. Section 17 of the Act, like Section 523 of the current code, employs the active voice to declare that a discharge, the subject of the sentence, does not discharge the bankrupt, or in the case of the current code, the individual debtor, which is the object of the sentence, whose debts are accepted from discharge. This contrasts to Section 33 of the 1867 Act, in which the sentence employs the passive voice that emphasizes the debt as the subject of the sentence. Again, quote, no debt created by the fraud or embezzlement of the bank shall be discharged. Accordingly, in the light of the inclusion of the term bankrupt or individual debtor as the object of the sentence in Section 17 of the 1898 Act, Section 523A2A of the current code, the elimination of the phrase of the bankrupt in the 1867 Act does not necessarily imply an expansion of the scope of the exception. Recasting of the sentence could easily be read as confirming that a discharge does not discharge the debt of the bankrupt or individual debtor that committed the fraud. Now, none of these points are conclusive. They merely lead to the need to use more tools in the toolbox of statutory construction, specifically to turn to the policy behind the discharge in bankruptcy. And to do so, we have to distinguish between A, the existence of a liability on a claim, a debt, under non-bankruptcy law, and in this case, state law, and B, the creation of discharge of debts and the exceptions to discharge under bankruptcy law. The court failed to recognize the distinction. It simply assumes that the state law of fraud and the state law rule for creating vicarious liability for fraud, which is in fact a separate body of state law, determines the bankruptcy law issue of discharge and its exceptions. For example, in its textual analysis in Part A of the opinion, the court observed that context can identify the missing actor, but stated that, quote, the relevant legal context, that of common law fraud, has long maintained that fraud liability is not limited to the wrongdoer, close quote. Later in Part C of the opinion, the court rejected petitioner's argument that interpreting 523A2A to bar the discharge of the vicarious liability of the innocent partner for the fraud of her partner violates the policy behind the discharge. Again, the court equated the considerations, including the balancing of interests of the debtor with the defrauded creditor, for creating the innocent debtor's vicarious liability under state law, with the considerations for accepting that vicarious liability from discharge. The court stated that state law and not 523A2A defines the reach of vicarious liability for fraud. The court then states, quote, Barton-Werfer's fairness-based critique seemed better directed toward the state law that imposed the obligation on her in the first place. I think this view is fundamentally wrong. Federal bankruptcy law provides a generally efficient procedure for adjusting the relationship between insolvent debtors and their creditors. That relation is created by non-bankruptcy law, which is primarily state law. To be sure, bankruptcy law alters the non-bankruptcy law rights of debtors and creditors. When it does so, however, it does so for bankruptcy law purposes. The automatic stay, the abrogation of ipso facto clauses, the avoidance of preferences are all examples. This case presents a similar example. Petitioner's debt in this case involved not just one body of state law, but two distinct bodies of state law. First, under the common law of fraud, a particular liability was created by the fraud of a person. Second, under agency and partnership state law, the fraud of the wrongdoer was attributed to the innocent partner in a general partnership. The creation of the liability by the combination of these two bodies of state law creates a debt in bankruptcy. However, that debt once created, how that debt once created is treated in bankruptcy is, however, a question of federal bankruptcy law and its policies. Therefore, the creation of vicarious liability for an innocent debtor for her partner's fraud from the application of two different bodies of state law should not automatically dictate the dischargeability or exception to dischargeability of that state law liability under bankruptcy law. To be sure, the exception from discharge depends on fraud. The debtor who commits the fraud is barred from discharge. A reference to fraud in section 523A2A implements the federal bankruptcy policy of discharge. To bar the discharge of the debtor who commits the fraud, the dishonest debtor. Bankruptcy law looks to state law to define the fraud of that debtor, just as bankruptcy law looks to other state and non-bankruptcy law to define other claims of creditors against the debtor. However, in asserting that the common law of fraud is not limited to the wrongdoer, the court conflated the two distinct sets of law that I mentioned, state law liability for actual fraud committed by the dishonest debtor, which is the concern of federal bankruptcy law policy, and the extension of vicarious liability for fraud to an innocent partner of the wrongdoer. Vicarious liability is a feature not just of fraud, but any liability created in a general partnership or agency relationship. I submit that accepting the vicarious liability for fraud from discharge violates the federal bankruptcy policy for the discharge of debt, the policy of providing an honest debtor relief from debt and denying relief to the dishonest debtor. There are no doubt good reasons why state law has created vicarious liability for an innocent partner for acts of another general partner, whether they be dishonest or simply careless or foolish, such as incurring liabilities for debts or for tortious acts. Between two innocent partners, the victims of the partner who actually created the liability and the innocent partner, it seems appropriate to allocate the risk of those liabilities to the innocent partner. The innocent partner may enjoy the fruits of the acts of the responsible partner. The innocent partner has perhaps a great ability to monitor the behavior of the other partner. Certainly, the rule creates an incentive for such monitoring. Under bankruptcy law, however, the purpose of the discharge is to relieve the honest but unfortunate debtor of debt, and therefore enable the honest debtor to become a more productive member of society. There has been over 300 years of experience that led to the purpose first fully recognized in the Bankruptcy Act of 1898. This experience shows that the continued burden on debtors whose debts are not discharged and the cost to society of such continued burden dwarf whatever benefit creditors may derive from the continued existence of such debts. Now, at this point, I would just like to note the phrase, the honest but unfortunate debtor, you know, may be a little inaccurate. There are plenty of individuals who become debtors not because they are unfortunate, but because they are foolish. Foolish debtors are not necessarily dishonest, and there may be times when it's difficult to draw the line between dishonest and difficult. But in any event, whatever situation, whether Kate's actions were foolish or she's just unfortunate, doesn't really matter. She was an honest debtor who obtained liability under state law. And in my view, her debt should have been discharged. Now, consistent with bankruptcy cop policy, of course, the dishonest debtor gets no relief. Dishonored debtors will continue to labor under the burden created by his or her fraud. Lack of relief may derive from an impulse to punish immoral behavior. Fraudsters do not deserve relief. Lack of relief may also benefit society more by convincing dishonest debtors that in the future, honesty is really the best policy. It may cause such debtor to mend his or her ways and in the future act more honestly. Should an innocent debtor who has incurred vicarious liability because of the fraud of another fall in the class of dishonest debtors? I don't think so. Now, sometimes the argument is made that the debtor received the benefit of the fraud, but I don't think that answers. Every debtor that incurs debts by borrowing money or acquiring property or services on credit has received the benefit of the actions that created the debt. In my view, denying an innocent debtor like the petitioner of a discharge violates the purpose of the discharge. Now, the court has spoken, so I think it's up to Congress to make any changes, and I hope Congress does so. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you about this case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.